Miles, hello and welcome to the Cease and Desist podcast. As I'd said before, we try and unpack the big sort of challenges, the case studies, the stories that sort of sit underneath this asset recovery sector, which we like to sort of frame as, the biggest and most important sector most people don't really know. Or understand, or certainly understand the complexities and the challenges. And I mean, this all came about because I was speaking at an event where you were the keynote speaker and sort of launching, not actually not launching your book, but I think your book has almost come around again because of geopolitically everything that's going on. And it seems very, very relevant to be talking about it now because underneath asset recovery, I mean, the origin of all asset recovery cases pretty much is money laundering. And money laundering is international. And I think your book does an incredible job that I'm halfway through. Admittedly, I'm not finished yet, but halfway through sort of linking together just the sheer business enterprise and interoperability and complexity that is international money laundering, which if there wasn't any, there wouldn't be asset recovery. So I'm really, really interested to dive in today. Miles, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, look, would you like to give us a bit about your background and what led you? And I promise we'll get all the generic book questions out of the way that everyone has to ask for our audience who weren't there the few weeks ago when we first met, and then we'll dive into some of the actual the stories themselves. But what led you to writing this particular book with your background?
Yeah, so my background is I started actually out as a music journalist when I was a lot younger, and a million miles away from writing about sort of international organized crime. And I did that for a couple of years freelance, and then sort of started to realize maybe this isn't what I want to be doing for the next sort of 20, 30 years. And I got lucky. I joined the FT as a trainee, and as a trainee, you basically are focusing on a lot of stuff to do, with business and finance and markets. And so that was really sort of my training at the Financial Times, just looking at financial markets, investing, hedge funds, these sorts of parts of the world, bond markets. And that again doesn't seem like the most obvious place to then eventually end up writing about international organized crime and money laundering, but it gave me a really strong training.
I have a very different opinion on that. I
Yeah.
think it's the perfect place to learn about money laundering.
Yeah, I mean maybe it is, but I mean it doesn't, so people sometimes are sort of surprised by that trajectory, but it's it what it really did was sort of I had to do a number of things in doing that job, which is firstly, often you're writing about things which are quite opaque. You could be writing about big financial funds and stuff that don't really want you to be writing about them, don't really want, or at least if you are writing about them, want the what you are saying to be very tightly controlled. So you need to kind of find ways into looking at organizations that are opaque and figuring out what they're doing from incomplete information. You need to figure out how to build sources in sort of these sorts of institutions. You also sort of need to get a grounding in how sort of the sort of underlying economics of things works. So you get a sort of pretty good handle on things like accounting and sort of ways in which things are structured. And so flash forward, several years later, I was doing a bunch of foreign postings. So I was in Spain and then later in the United States in New York, and I ended up in Rome for the FT. And whilst I was in Rome, I started to get really, really interested in organized crime in Italy because I started to see the ways in which it overlapped with what we would regard as the sort of regular conventional financial world. And so, you have these big organized crime families and sort of big networks which are, really doing serious numbers in terms of revenues. It's obviously it's a shadow market. They don't publish audited annual statements and stuff, but the estimates, you sort of in terms of just like things like what one would expect, like cocaine trafficking and extortion and stuff like that. These are big. They would rank as fairly large private companies, and increasingly as these entities, these families get bigger, more global, more sophisticated, they start to interact more with the regular financial world. And so that's sort of where I started to explore the sort of world of organized crime and starting to see those parallels and use those same sort of, I guess, reporting techniques as I used with hedge funds to sort of report on those sorts of entities. And that was my sort of way in.
But, and it is a fair, or well, do you believe it is a fair comparison that, I mean, you've just highlighted a, you know, multi-year approach, completely international. I mean, should we be thinking about these organizations rather than thinking about them as the, you know, the cliche, what we see in the movies, as just, you know, businesses, albeit illegal, but actually they are run like sophisticated hedge funds. They are run like, you know, appreciate there's not as many, you know, regulations, and like you say, they don't exactly publish audited annual accounts. But what was, like, what was that big takeaway? Were you surprised by just how sheerly, you know, just organized this was, and the sort of the interoperability? Because that's something you talk a lot about in your book, you know, stitching together what could seem like completely distinct groups. I almost compare it to, like, you know, like Tesla built their car, but they also built the batteries, and then lots of other companies rely on Tesla for the batteries. So a lot of people won't know that they're the infrastructure provider to other electric cars and just see the shiny Tesla motor out front. That was what I was getting a lot from the book, was just for, which blew me away. And I knew about it anecdotally, but not to the level that you had covered it, about how these different groups from your traditional narcotics dealers would rely on, you know, they maybe do shipping well and someone else also does, you know, the logistics, or they maybe do money laundering better, or they, you know, understand crypto better and emerging technologies. I mean, what did you see when you looked at those sort of, like, the comparison to the traditional corporate and tech world?
I think, I guess, if you're applying that same framework as you would to a sort of business, you'd look at the sort of, you know, the sort of micro economics of the business, and then sort of the more sort of macro or market structural aspects. And I think in terms of, you know, on the first one, you know, you'd see, you know, what makes certain crime organizations different and more resilient to others. And, you know, just within Italy on its own, you know, where my sort of reporting began and then later kind of went beyond the borders of Italy to, you know, Latin America, the United States, other parts of Europe, the Middle East. But, you know, if you look, start at the beginning, you'd say, you know, in Italy, you know, the famous mafia, the one which people sort of see as synonymous with the mafia, the Sicilian Cosa Nostra. And, you know, they've obviously became world famous, are featured in, you know, Hollywood movies, and, you know, everyone kind of knows who they are. But, you know, they went into, you know, after really becoming unbelievably powerful in the 1980s, you know, sort of in the 1990s, were sort of eventually sort of really broken up and destroyed by the Italian state, to the extent where they're now, you know, very much sort of a shadow of their former selves. But the power really shifted to a much less known and sort of quieter sort of mafia constellation, which was in Calabria. So that's sort of, that's the sort of the toe, you know, sort of the sort of foot of Italy, right? The south, sort of facing Sicily, is the region of Calabria. It's not as well known as Sicily, but these families, if you're looking at it from a sort of micro level, they're extremely resilient structures. So basically, because they're based on blood ties and intermarriage, it means that they have a huge amount of sort of generational continuity, which sort of makes them distinct and different. There are similar different crime organizations in Europe and around the world which have some similar characteristics, but just looking at them, it means that from that micro level, like, why does this work, so to speak, as a business? You know, because you have
that, like, durability, and
yeah, it creates that durability because, you know, there's several you know, sort of, like, I call it, you could sort of call it in sort of offensive and defensive sort of benefits to that structure, where, you know, because you can't just sign up and join, you know, you have to be a relative or marry in, it means they're quite resilient, they're difficult to infiltrate for the police, you know, because basically people are less likely to want to sort of become a state witness and betray their entire family. That makes it tricky. They're also, there is continuity there, which is really appealing to their business relationships, their clients, and their suppliers. So if you're a cocaine cartel in Colombia, you are looking for European customers, and you want someone who's going to be there next year, and ideally in 5 years, and ideally in 10 years, because it's really annoying if you invest all of this time and effort to create this relationship with a drug trafficking organization, and then they get busted, they're gone, and now you need to find a new person and devote all that effort again. Whereas if you have this resilient structure where if the boss is arrested, then his brother takes over, or his son takes over, or his nephew takes over.
You've probably met the deputy at countless meetings, and now all of a sudden he's being promoted. Yeah.
Exactly. So there's this
which ironically is like, it's like brand in startups and in companies.
Exactly. It's a strong brand. You know, these people are serious. They have resources. They have this kind of continuity of people. They're going to be around. So it's worth investing in this relationship. And it means that you have these deeper relationships that go over long periods of time, which facilitate that critical sort of supply of, you know, cocaine being trafficked from Latin America to Europe. And so that's one sort of aspect on the sort of like the micro level. On the macro level, you know, the thing which was instantly really interesting to me was that, you know, the European cocaine industry is sort of sometimes not really seen as distinct in its sort of the economic drivers to, you know, what's happening in, you know, between the Mexican and US border or something like that. And, you know, I sort of spent a lot of time at the start, like talking to people in law enforcement and other experts, you know, people who'd really spent their careers watching this phenomenon of how, you know, cocaine trafficking in Europe exploded over the last sort of 20, 30 years. And, you know, it's sort of become, you know, multi-billion dollar market and one which sort of rivals the US market, the North American market in size. And I'm like, sort of, why is that? You know, what are the sort of macro
factors? Did they just get really good at it? Or like, no, how did they...
Yeah,
grow that business.
I mean, so then you know, so you think like, you know, if you look at it from just any other business market, you would see, you know, the sort of things that stand out immediately of, you know, firstly, you know, if structural reasons where, you know, if you're a Colombian cartel and you're trying to sell drugs into the United States, you are basically sort of cut out by, or a lot of the economic value is taken by the Mexican cartels because they control the borders, you know, that sort of critical real estate, you know, in terms of moving cocaine from, you know, through Central America into the United States. So the economic value, if you're a supplier in Colombia, is like way reduced, you know, because basically you have these people taking
a literal and geographical middleman.
Yes, exactly. And so suddenly it becomes much more tempting to look towards Europe for other reasons, because, you know, secondly, if you start trafficking drugs into the United States, you attract the attention of U.S. law enforcement. And people, even the sort of toughest, scariest drug lords in Latin America are very, very concerned about the DEA. You know, you know, U.S. law enforcement is very aggressive and effective, and you really would like to not have them on your case. And so if you, instead of trafficking into the United States, you traffic into Europe, it's slightly changed, but you would attract less attention. You would just be less likely to attract the attention of US law enforcement. And that is a good thing if you are a drug trafficking organization. And then lastly, the price of, you know, of a kilogram of cocaine in Europe was historically much higher than in the United States. So you would be able to make more money by sending it into Europe. The infrastructure in Europe is there because you have these massive ports, you know, like Rotterdam, Antwerp, you know, in Calabria, have Gioia Tauro. You have these ports which are already there. They're massive in, you know, container ports.
Access to mainland Europe, yeah.
Access to mainland Europe.
Well, actually everywhere, access to West and Central Asia, the whole lot. Once you hit one of those land masses, that's it.
Yeah. So, you know, so from that sort of like, you know, macro, you know, just a top-down perspective, like what's not to like in terms of, you know, basically is that this is a lower risk, higher margin, and you have, you know, just generally an easier time. There was a period of time, and I think it was perceived that law enforcement in Europe was more fragmented. So, you know, you're less likely, you know, because of the complexity of, you know, the setup, you know, you might be able to traffic something into Rotterdam and then, you know, ship it down to Spain or something. And, you know, and you're crossing borders, which increases the complexity of law enforcement coming after you. And so that was sort of initially sort of what, you know, sort of stood out to me, that this was, for a certain period of time, just really looked like a perfect setup. And obviously, one really, really important fact is obviously Europe is a rich place, you know, with high GDP per capita and a, you know, willing consumer base to buy those sorts of products. So that was sort of like the origins of, you know, my sort of entry into that world by talking to people.
And would it be right in saying that, I mean, those same, let's say, sort of cartel leads in sort of Latin America and across that continent, yes, they're maybe using the EU as a gateway into, you know, there's just mainland Europe in general, and throwing in Switzerland and Monaco and all those, you know, high net worth places, as you mentioned. I'm right in assuming, but their laundering was probably being done in the US. Like they're not necessarily trying to then buy a house in Italy. They're probably buying a house in Miami over the border, or they're probably buying a house. I mean, do you see that? Was that still a risk that you were aware of? Where the DEA, was there a footprint financially in the US, or was all of their operations distinctly separate that they were then actually laundering proceeds in Europe versus going to the US?
I think, with the people, because the sort of time horizon of the book is sort of broadly sort of 2014 to about 2017. Mm-hmm. And the people I was looking at, basically principally European actors, okay. While the law enforcement is US. And I think they sort of would tend to, every sort of organization has its own, so priorities for laundering money, and some are sort of more sophisticated than others. And I think one of the things which really stuck out to me was, we frequently think of, which is a really important part of it, but we think of money laundering as, people laundering the proceeds of their criminal acts, for their own, to build their own wealth and, accumulate benefits to themselves. So, buying a mansion somewhere with the money they've made from their crimes. But one of the things which I hadn't really thought about in depth before was when I was looking at these the stories, the sort of cases that were the sort of starting base for this book. These are really, really detailed indictments of like thousands of pages, and you really get into the sort of like the weeds in terms of how the conspiracies come together. And one key money laundering thing that I hadn't really thought about that much was that, when we think of international drugs trafficking, we think of people shipping cocaine loads to Europe, for example, on container ships. Like that's just intuitive. Someone somewhere hides a bunch of sort of narcotics in a boat or in a container ship, and it goes into a port and people take it off. But that's almost the easy part, because there are just so many tens of thousands of container ships coming in, containers on ships coming into Europe.
Numbers game.
Yeah, it's a numbers game. It's like, it's just logistically impossible without specific intelligence to, like, you can't just search every container. Like global trade would just grind to a halt. So that is a sort of, it's a well-known, thing, which I'm sure your listeners would sort of be familiar with, that, the amount actually caught is a tiny fraction of the amount that gets through. So it's just that's sort of the easy side. But one thing which is really much trickier is, let's say you are that drug trafficking organization, in this book, an Italian, the Calabrian mafia boss, and you're trying to buy 8 tons of cocaine from a Colombian cartel. You need to figure out how to pay them. You need to figure out how to get a really large amount of cash, physical cash, and then give it to someone who is trustworthy, who will then be able to move that cash through, the international system to them. And you can't really transport that cash physically. Like, you could, but it's quite difficult and quite risky. Doing the reverse trade, just getting, 100 million euros, 200 million euros, and sticking it in a container ship and sending it to Colombia doesn't really work very well. That's something where, how do you make sure that money isn't lost? How can you trust the people on board? How can you have eyes over the whole process? It's bad. So you need to, the thing which was really eye-opening to me was that there are these really specialist organizations that focus on money laundering as a service for these criminal groups. And they're the really critical sort of nodes in how this international sort of criminality works, because they're the people who, in the book, there is a sort of critical scene where Salvatore, the Italian, the Calabrian mafia boss, he travels to Rome and he meets a guy in a kind of apartment who is working on behalf of the people who are selling him the drugs in Colombia. So he doesn't know who this guy is, and he drops the money with this guy. And this guy is a Lebanese money launderer who then flies off to Beirut a couple of days later. And then the money moves through these sorts of various means to eventually end up in Colombia. And those people, like that money launderer, they're not dealing in drugs. They're not trafficking drugs. They are trafficking in money. And they are taking a cut, and it's a big business. The rate they charge could be, depending on the market, could be 10%, it could be 5%. But they're the people who allow this trade to happen. Without them, it wouldn't work, because you wouldn't be able to pay people, because it's just a critical logistical problem you have to overcome in that sort of business or organization, where you have your cash on the ground, but how do you get your cash to the people who are supplying you thousands of miles away? So I found that sort of money laundering as a service world fascinating.
And I think that was highlighted. I think it was an event that you and I were at a couple months ago, maybe with Rusi. The NCA highlighted that in Operation Destabilize, where you had this sort of Russian-linked money laundering network, which had this enormous scale. I'm just looking it up now. I know across 30-plus countries. It was deeply entwined with ransomware, drug gangs, sanctioned elites in Russian espionage, you can nearly say that. But what was interesting for me was that it was the opposite. It was the cash for crypto. So they were one of those nodes that you said, and they were like, bring us your cash and we will sort of get this into the network. Were you seeing the same sort of interaction? Or I suppose if you were looking at 14 to 17, that maybe, you know, crypto wasn't maybe as big of a, without putting words in your mouth, but did crypto play a large part in much of that? Or did that come up in much of your research?
No, it didn't at all, actually. And it's quite interesting. I mean, you know, the people I was speaking to, there's quite a lot of debate over, you know, the role of crypto. And, you know, I think there's some money laundering law enforcement people I speak to who obviously think that crypto is a massively important and growing part of money laundering. And then there are others who say, okay, crypto is really cool and trendy, but really at the end of the day, the vast amount of money laundering is still just cash. And so, you know, there is a... you know, that case you mentioned, the NCA case, was really interesting because it was one of a, you know, relatively few like sort of in the wild case studies and examples of this sort of behavior becoming public. And, you know, I think it's sort of it clearly still is a it clearly is a thing. I think it's just you know, one of the simplest ways, one of the undetectable ways to launder money is still in, you know, cash. You know, and it's just you know, crypto makes it a lot easier, and a lot of criminals will be taking advantage of that, especially across international borders. But it's still, you know, it's easier to be detected doing stuff in crypto than it is with physical cash, because obviously physical cash is entirely fungible and leaves no trace, and you don't need to use a tumbler. It's just a pain. It's just the annoying thing is you have, you know,
there's a high technical barrier to entry as well. And I think people forget that some of the people running these networks, you know, maybe are someone in their, you know, 60s or 70s. They weren't brought up or educated around crypto assets. There may be a natural skepticism, you know, and it's not an ageist thing to say that, you know, the practical realities of, if you're the head of an organized crime boss and someone says, pitches you, there's a thing with a ledger wallet and a, I mean, lots of people and lots of, you know, police chiefs from a generational point of view are skeptical about, you know, how crypto works. So I think those that are money laundering using crypto understand the technology and also or have been convinced that this is the way to go. And we're seeing that. But the reason I was so keen to speak to you today as well was, I mean, we talk about asset recovery. At Asset Reality is the problem we're trying to solve. Yes, we're mainly known for digital asset seizure. We've built a platform to make digital asset seizure easier. But it's because it's one of the key things within the asset recovery world that we're trying to solve. Because, and you sum it up perfectly, I mean, the absolute elephant in the room is always the trillions laundered through the existing financial system pre-crypto and has continued to this day, that there is just no unimaginable amounts of money. We don't even know how much it is. We just estimate it. UNODC puts it at 4 to 6%. Other sets closer to 10% of GDP. Mm-hmm. We just accept trillions are laundered every single year, despite decades and decades of compliance training and enforcement and investment and billions spent on the compliance industry. I mean, what sort of led you to this particular story? And I think the layperson will be very interested in why is, you know, the central character of the book, this, you know, the Jack Kelly, who I think you had said at our talk, his name almost sounds made up, and it's like Dick Tracy, and it's not. What has a DEA, you know, US-based entity and their officer got? Why are they acting on these cases in Italy? I think, you know, the layperson may not understand. And what led you to him and this particular story that is the sort of central spine of the book?
So the way in which US law enforcement sort of come into the picture is, you know, the book captures this moment in the history of the DEA, which is quite, I found quite fascinating where, you know, sort of in the period after 9/11 and that sort of early noughties period, there was this really big expansion in the sort of mandate through a sort of series of US legislation changes and the focus of the DEA into being this sort of much more aggressive, internationally focused agency, which was sort of doing all of these things that people had never really seen before in terms of pulling off these kind of quite crazy international sting operations targeting sort of arms dealers and you know, people who weren't directly immediately tied into drug trafficking. And that was because, you know, under sort of various changes to sort of US statutes, there were sort of expansions in the remit of the DEA in terms of what they could go after. You know, if it was sort of people who were interacting with designated terrorist organizations, which had any interaction at all with any type of drugs activity, you know, which could be quite broad. So in terms of the DEA in that period in time, it had a massive jump in its funding. It was given a lot more tools. So it was sort of formally brought into the US intelligence community. And, you know, Jack Kelly, the DEA agent in the book, he joins this thing called the Special Operations Division, which it existed since the 90s, I think, but it was had really been beefed up by that point. And it was its sort of main role was sort of as a sort of clearinghouse almost for all of this information that was coming in from the DEA's networks of informants from around the world and DEA, you know, agents. And they would get this sort of intelligence, you know, from one country, which might actually interact with something happening in another country. And so someone might be able to, you know, someone in France, for example, might be able to get somehow into a money laundering network, which is interacting with, you know, a drug trafficking organization in Colombia. And so that would be routed back to the Special Operations Division through people like Jack. And then they would be able to start building cases sort of which would cross borders and working with the agents on the ground. And so the stuff in the book is really at the sort of almost the tail end of that moment where there was this brief period of time, you know, around a decade where the DEA was, yeah, really doing these things that quite surprised and shocked people in terms of how audacious they were. You know, they were doing these really complicated undercover sting operations in, you know, faraway countries, pulling in people like Victor Bout and like Monzar Kassar, these sort of, you know, famous arms dealers, and, you know, working on them undercover for months and then doing these dramatic sort of arrests in hotel rooms in Thailand and stuff like that. People, you know, in other US government agencies were quite sort of shocked and surprised by this. People were also sort of, I guess, to a certain extent, envious. You know, it really depends on who you're talking to. But people,
well, remember, this is the agency that took out Escobar, you know, in a pretty sort of outlandish sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they have a long history of doing these things, you know, they were getting results in terms of bringing in these big figures, some of whom people thought were sort of untouchable, but they were also ruffling feathers, to say the least. And people were saying, you know, what are they doing in this place? You know, why are they doing stuff in the Middle East? Like, why are they doing stuff in Asia? Like, what does that have to do with them? And so, like all, you know, sort of a really important part of the book is, you know, is trying to capture the sort of complexities of those sorts of interagency dynamics. And, you know, Jack Kelly is working on his sort of cases, which are around money laundering connected to the Middle East and Hezbollah and how that interacts with Colombian drug traffickers and stuff in Europe. And you know, he runs up against a lot of obstacles. And, you know, his boss, who was the head of the Special Operations Division at the time, a man called Derek Maltz, you know, sort of warns him early on in the book. He basically says, you know, like, you're gonna get into a lot of scrapes. There's gonna be a lot of people trying to stop you. And I think, you know, the thing about this book is that it is not meant to be. It is a depiction of, you know, it's is reality, is what happened, and it is like things that happen in real life. It is not, it doesn't fit perfectly into sort of a Hollywood narrative arc, in the sense of, you know, it really shows that actually the process of doing these sorts of cases can be extremely frustrating. It's not this sort of perfect unfolding thing where this, like, you know, team of police do this perfect case and everything's
Do you
perfect.
know, I have to interrupt you, because that's what made me chuckle when I was researching the book for this podcast. Some of the reviews that weren't as positive as others were like, it's a bit complicated. And you're like, of course it's complicated. It is international organized crime, narcotics and money laundering, with organizations that were formed on maybe no ideological grounds, who blatantly are making their money, no, selling heroin. Let's not let beat around the bush, or others that are claiming they are, no, they have a cause. And I've seen this everywhere from, you know, Northern Ireland, where people are, you know, religiously sort of motivated allegedly, but then they'll have lots of operations they do together because they make money that way. And no, drugs and prostitution and counterfeiting's all fine, but no, how dare you sort of, no, take my religion into bad name. And I think you highlight that beautifully, where actually, if the profit is right, if the trust framework is in place, you can have cyber criminals working with religiously motivated groups, working with, you know, international narcotics dealers. Like, if it works, it works. And it that is almost like the Hollywood cliche of them all sitting around. I mean, it's not just the five families who all come from the same, like, you know, religious or traditional or economic background. It literally is the cliche Middle Eastern mysterious man, and the cyber hacker, and the, you know, Latin American sort of drug smuggler. And the so yeah, that for me was one of the things that drew me to it, because people that were trying to wrap this up as a simple Hollywood arc, I mean, are doing a disservice to the men and women who are trying to investigating what is clearly the most complicated crime type in the world, which, in my personal opinion, which is why we have the lowest detection rates in the world. That's why we have this sort of famous 1%. So sorry, I had to cut in on your naysayers who said it's a bit complicated.
Yeah, no,
That's
I'm
not co-
pleased. At least you say that. I mean, it's yeah, as you say, you know, it's ultimately, you know, this is a work
The quantum physics, I couldn't follow it.
you know, it's a work of nonfiction. It's journalism. It's you know, it's based on everything is factual in this book. So it depicts reality. You know, reality is sadly, it's not simple, and things are extremely complicated, and often these sort of phenomena, stuff which are, you know, mind-blowingly complicated, occurring across, you know, multiple borders, involving lots of different types of groups, and so the sort of neat Hollywood ending is, you know, I don't want to give away the ending in the book, but you know, it's you know, things in these sorts of cases don't always end up as a sort of happily ever
What do you
after
mean? It
moment.
doesn't end with all money laundering stopped and all narcotics shut down and all terrorism stopped? Damn
No,
it. Spoiler alert.
I will. Yeah, that's spoiler alert. It does not end with all of those things being defeated. And so, you know, there is this element of you know, it's about institutions. You know, so it's also, this is really a book which because it looks at, you know, the DEA and the Italian mafia side, and the side in Syria, with Hezbollah. You know, these are all, it focuses on three people who ultimately are working in institutions. They may be very different institutions with a completely different aims, but these are three people who, at least ostensibly, in different ways, believe in something. Now, you know, if you are you know, in the you know, Italian mafia guy like Salvatore in the book, you know, your beliefs are pretty dark and twisted, but you believe, at
You
least
think
you have a
you're
moral
right?
code. Yeah, you think you're right. And you know, he you know, I've read through like thousands and thousands of pages of you know, sort of evidence and transcripts and wiretap intercepts and, you know, testimony and stuff and witnesses and stuff about, you know, this guy. And you know, he's someone who clearly believes that his worldview is correct. You know, that, like, he is the people who he's sort of killing, to a certain extent, like, deserve it. Whereas you know, someone like Mustafa Badreddin, the Hezbollah sort of bomb maker in this book, he is someone who, again, sort of clearly goes on some sort of ideological journey. You know, in terms of, this is someone who now is in their 50s, who took that path when they were in their 20s. People's sort of objectives and motivations and ideology change over time. And you know, with Jack Kelly, he's someone who is trying to Bring in these cases in a world which is so sort of sprawling and chaotic, where there's just these oceans of sort of illicit money like traveling around the world, and he is sort of faced with trying to kind of try and place some order, some sort of law enforcement sort of interpretative like framework on what he's seeing. And all of these people are in these institutions which make life in some ways quite difficult for them. Ultimately, the things that they believe in will, to a certain extent, end up betraying them or disappointing them in some way. Like Salvatore has a sort of, works within a system that sort of, ultimately isn't really there for him when he needs it in the end. Jack Kelly is constantly fighting against these sort of internal roadblocks and things that just make him this is a potentially a career case. This is something where he, at a certain point in his story, he believes that he's going to bring down this huge case. And things don't always work out perfectly. And I think so in terms of the sort of complexity of the book, it really is that it in real life, as I'm sure all of your listeners know, like things don't always work out in the perfect Hollywood way, and things can be quite frustrating. But for me that was a really important part of the story, because that's the way things actually are.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And we've actually had on the podcast, and we've had very, very senior executives and chiefs from IRS Criminal Investigation, US Secret Service. I mean, these are people, to your point, that operate in agencies that people probably are surprised that they're involved in the cases they're involved in. When you say to the person in the street, Secret Service, and they think, protecting the president, and they probably don't realize that Secret Service has a mandate over anything that affects the US dollar. Like they can literally lawfully put their nose in any sort of case. Similar with IRS-CI. It's financial crime, not tax, even though it's IRS. So again, every single child exploitation case, narcotics case, human trafficking case, they all have a financial element to it. And am I right in saying that, this is just my assumption, but the DEA, post 9/11, the Patriot Act, a lot of the anti-money laundering controls were actually on the books from way back from the Banking Secrecy Act in the late 70s, but they really got supercharged with the Patriot Act. You and I had mentioned sort of before we jumped on camera, the underlying sort of nature and wealth of a lot of these large organized crime books that funds terrorism basically is the underlying narcotics. So is that the reason why people will see DEA operating on a narcotics case in across the Middle East and across Italy, for example? Is it because of that link that the narcotics plays a part in the terrorist financing? Or what was your understanding of why the DEA would be involved in one of those types of cases? Or was it just purely narcotics globally? They have a remit because it'll eventually hit American soil.
Yeah, I think it's sort of broadly speaking a bit of both of those. I mean, in terms of the legislative prongs which they would be using, I think the sort of, in the sort of backdrop to that period, there was very, this sort of stuff was really happening at its sort of height in the sort of the first decade of the 21st century, where it was really much in the shadow of 9/11 and the sort of the reaction and the reshaping of US law enforcement and sort of counterterrorism in those years. So everything was sort of to a certain extent being framed that way. But then also you have at its heart, like this sort of central problem, which has always been there for the DEA, where it's like, if you are a trafficking organization, you're not necessarily almost certainly going to be in the United States. So you might be trafficking stuff into the United States directly, or you might be trafficking it indirectly, but still playing an important role in that. But if you're not in the United States, how does US law enforcement go after you, unless they can prove that a crime is taking place on US soil? It's sort of like, so there have been these various sort of laws and change to the laws which sort of allowed that sort of overseas activity. So overseas activity has always been in the sort of DNA of that organization. As you said, you mentioned Escobar, like going back to that, like, big footprints operating on the ground and in countries like Colombia. And so to a certain extent, this was like a expansion of that. But it's also, they can do things which other people can't, to a certain, they can, firstly, they're sort of less threatening than other agencies when they're on foreign soil. Foreign governments in lots of countries might get quite twitchy if, people from the FBI are doing stuff on their soil, whereas with the DEA, they can forge quite strong relationships with local law enforcement.
No one's gonna say yes to narcotics. Like, it's always there is no religious ideology. There's no, we should all be on the same page in relation to sort of narcotics globally.
Yeah, and they're less they have less of a they have sort of a intelligence sort of angle to them, and they can sort of, you can be like seen as sort of willing and helpful partners to local law enforcement, and share sort of information which they coming into them. And so I think that they've been pretty effective at building those good partnerships. But we have to say, like, in that was then, the context has changed hugely now. I mean, we haven't had, to my knowledge, one of those like really big blockbuster sting operations in a long time. And the focus has changed to a certain extent with the political climate in the United States. So that that unit as it was, and these sorts of teams of agents doing these big complicated, months long, even years long sort of sting operations, sort of being, to a certain extent wound down, or there is there's important reasons for that. That we said that this sort of stuff was happening in the shadow of 9/11, and with the sort of war fatigue in the United States, and sort of people being sort of talking of like sort of forever wars, and wanting to get out of them, the appetite for doing big overseas stuff has diminished, whilst at the same time you've had a huge opioid crisis in the United States, and people politically, sort of in Congress and the like, say, wait a minute, why are you guys, running around the Balkans chasing an arms dealer when we've got a huge opioid crisis on the streets of America? And so it makes it, the sort of political winds have changed. And so that era, which is in this book and probably closes with this book, in that sort of time period around 2016, 17, that might never come back. It was sort of this quite audacious and unprecedented law enforcement experiment, which had never happened before and may never be repeated.
Yeah, and especially with this push, and obviously accelerated by COVID and lockdowns, and now we seem to be in this cyber scam fraud epidemic that is now becoming industrialized. And I think that there's probably countless books in the offing right now just looking at the sheer industrial scale. It was actually just this weekend I was watching an old French foreign film, Only the Animals, from like 2019, and it actually does a really interesting job at looking at the Ivory Coast and the cyber scams and romance scams. And just as you were talking about, like, Hezbollah and others and organizations that were founded on a political or religious ideology, but then make a lot of money from trafficking drugs and people, for example, it was interesting the perspective that a lot of the cyber scams were almost blaming, that there was almost, I'm not saying civic pride, and I'm not just putting in a whole bucket of people, but it was interesting the motivation and the why you can commit these things. It was more a case of, it was very much clearly blamed on, look at the state of our country because of the colonial history. I mean, we're just taking back. We're fighting back. And it wasn't. And when you see some of these scam factories, it's not now. We've seen some horrific cases in sort of Southeast Asia, highlighted by a former guest of the show, Aaron West, and Operation Shamrock, where you have factories in like Myanmar and places, casinos converted, that are call centers now. And they're filled with trafficked people to go and scam. But then you also have organizations that are running these sort of large sort of scam networks. And I think, as you're right, I think we might have moved on now to the next wave of political appetite, that it'll probably take something like, tragically, a terrorist incident or something to refocus, because this better than anybody as a journalist. If it's the old, if it bangs or bleeds, it'll tend to lead. And that was one of my complaints as someone now outside of law enforcement, looking back and looking at the research, I mean, why don't we have standalone money laundering charges? You can do that internationally. Virtually every country in the world has legislation for money laundering. And it is very rare that there is a money laundering case, despite all of the stats and facts and evidence. I think one of the few standalone money laundering cases in the world was a conviction in relating to the OneCoin scam in Kosovo. And even that, I think, was appealed. And it looks like it might be wobbly now. And it was a pure, you're just laundering. Whereas usually you catch the drug dealer and you get the money laundering charge. Or you catch anyone in any crime and money laundering is always a bolt on. I mean, from the research that you've carried out, and I know we've talked about the sheer complexity, but is that it? Is that what it's down to? Why aren't you able, as part of your research, to see dozens, if not scores, of these types of cases and these types of results? And why is it that people like, you know, Jack Kelly, your sort of central character, why does it seem so difficult for them to, you know, fight the good fight and go and do these large cases? What do you think is the big challenge about investigating these money laundering cases? Is it just the sheer scale and complexity?
Yeah, I think it's to a certain extent that, you know, these are really, really hard, labor intensive, resource intensive cases that can, you know, take years, be really hard to pin down. And you might, as you mentioned, you know, in some countries, you might not even have the laws in place to really, get a big conviction. You know, I think political appetite can be, I don't want to overly generalize, but, you know, can people, I think no one believes that money laundering is a victimless crime, but it's going to attract less attention than other crimes where the victims are more apparent. You know, so sort of, it's seen as a less, you know, there's maybe a perception that it's seen as a slightly less serious crime, or that there are lots of plausible.
And that's usually down to a misunderstanding of realizing it's the fuel that keeps all of the crimes going. If there is no money laundering, there is no commercial appetite to go and commit crimes.
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. It is the fuel. And it is, you know, it is sometimes, you know, the really like the key enabler of these sorts of bigger networks. They wouldn't be able to function without that money laundering function. And I think, you know, you can see this where in some jurisdictions, you know, the sentencing for money laundering is pretty low. You know, it's you know, if you just you know, if you traffic 20 million euros of cocaine and you're caught, you will go down for a very long time, pretty much in most places. But if you launder 20 million euros, you know, you might get sometimes 4 years, 5 years, you know, depending, you know, sort of, you know, it's possible. I've seen lots of cases where people have had like, you know, 7 year convictions and got out in like five or something. And
for multi-million dollar laundering.
Yeah. And where, you know, the evidence, and in every single case, I think without exception, you know, they're always like, oh, I had no idea. I never knew that I was doing this, you know, and there is that sort of, I guess, plausible deniability where, you know, you can make a legal argument compared to being caught red handed with, you know, sort of guns or drugs, you know, with money, you'll be like, oh, but I didn't know where the money came from. And I think that is always just going to be in every money laundering case, probably the most obvious defense. But I think, you know, and also some of the profile of these people can be different, you know, so whereas, you know, sort of gun runners or drug traffickers or something might be sort of have the appearance of, you know, hardened people from the criminal underworld, potentially with, you know, strings of previous offenses, criminal records. You know, the money launderers could be very boring, kind of, you know, white collar professionals who are just like,
you can call them bankers. Let's call them what they are.
Bankers. Yeah. Or bankers, you know, they could just be people who will say, you know, they appear like upstanding members of society and they'll just say, oh, you know, I never knew that this guy was, you know, sort of drug lords from the Balkans, you know, when I was moving his money into this investment fund in Luxembourg. Like, I had no clue. Like, I did my KYC. We did the due diligence. Yeah. And so, you know, and that is frequently, you know, quite effective. And people, you know, I've seen this a lot, you know, where people really should know, and it's fairly implausible that they don't know, and the thing looks fairly, at least in hindsight, fairly screamingly obvious, but then they'll say, we did all the checks, you know, we had no idea. And And so I think that's probably a pretty big reason behind it. You know, it just doesn't, unless you're, and also it's just a number, the numbers, just, you know, just from, you know, when we write about this sort of stuff, you know, people, you know, their eyes glaze over a little bit about just numbers.
You become numb to it. Yeah, you become, like we saw when one of the, even now we see it with the crypto community. I mean, you just have to look at a list of all of the different crypto exchanges. I mean, even ones that are registered in the UK, and it's like, no, pay a multi-million pound fine and multi-million dollar fine, and it doesn't even tarnish people anymore. I mean, like some of the biggest players, public companies like Coinbase. I mean, it's not a slight on the individual members of staff, but the fact is, as an organization, they have been fined. You know, Binance, their CEO and founder, was locked up for these charges. And it's because, I mean, we used to debate a lot, and you know, when people would talk about, you know, these exchanges, and like my theory on it is kind of, but what have we done with the traditional finance? I mean, how many people at the big banks who have been blatantly involved in sanctions evasion, laundering for the cartels, how many of those individual banks and attorneys and lawyers and, you know, the attorneys and lawyers who have actually been convicted, like how many of them have got substantial prison sentences? So if we don't set that benchmark in traditional money laundering, how then can we expect to see people in exchanges being locked up for decades?
It just never happens. Like, you know, I've written so many stories about sanctions evasion, you know, with, you know, like Russia and Iran and various places. And, you know, every single time we do one of these stories, you know, we will contact the people involved, obviously, before we publish, or the bank or something. And there has never once been a case where any of the stories about this published by me or my colleagues or anyone else, they have ever said, yep, I knew who they were, and I'm sorry, like, yep, I was breaking sanctions, and so what, or whatever. Or like, yep, I'm sorry I broke sanctions. They always say definitively, you know, we had no idea who they were. We never could have had any idea who they were. We asked them. You know, there's obviously this absurd case with, you know, we wrote a lot about Yevgeny Prigozhin, the warlord, the boss of the Wagner Group, the Russian mercenaries. And he was an interesting character because obviously he was this sort of murderous, you know, warlord, this mercenary boss. But he was also a businessman who had a bunch of companies, loads of international shell companies, lawyers in London, lawyers in, you know, the EU, lawyers in Russia, you know, very company formation agents, accountants. And we did a lot of stuff on his sort of professional network. And they all just said, we could have never known that he was a warlord. It was impossible. Like, you know, we did all of our checks. And yeah, no, but you know, at the time he was, but if you Googled him, you would have seen all of this extremely credible and subsequently 100% vindicated journalism showing that he was engaged in, you know, this sort of mercenary activity. And, you know, he staunchly denied it, and he sued people. But he sued journalists for reporting this stuff. You know, he hired really expensive lawyers and sued them in England, which is really, 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 you know, dangerous for news organizations, because you can rack up massive, massive bills. And he said, you know, I've been emotionally, you know, caused a huge amount of emotional distress for these journalists saying that I was a warlord, you know, and then he sues them. But, you know, subsequently, obviously,
the warlord's feelings got hurt.
Yeah. And then subsequently, you know, like a year later, he's running around. Firstly, he publicly admits, he's like, ahaha, I actually am a warlord, and I have been one all along. And he admits it. And then he's running around on like rooftops in Ukraine with like sort of automatic weapons and stuff. So he was just completely lying. But in the time, you know, before that happened, it was very, very difficult for anyone to report. And all of the lawyers would just say, even though there was that reporting out there, they would just say, we asked him and he told us he wasn't a warlord. So it was fine. And that's it. I mean, that's the end of the story. Like, you know,
I was going to ask you, what is the next book? But it sounds like that could be it. I mean, I think understanding, because you're right. I was actually going to ask you about, you know, because we've had Oliver Bullough on the show. We've had Jeff White on the show. And I mean, when you hear just the sheer aggressive, there's two parts of this. The UK obviously is a large financial center, and London specifically plays a massive part in global money laundering, even if not by design or by blind eye. And I know Oliver Bullough has an entire book on sort of the UK's role and sort of in money laundering as a service, allegedly. That on one side, you could look at it as, well, it's just going to happen because it's a large financial center. anyway. But is there scope, just to ask you for your own, you know, personal opinions, is there scope for some sort of, not necessarily retrospective, but like in those types of cases, there has to be accountability. You used the example a moment ago where, I mean, you don't get a massive sentence if you're caught money laundering, because how did you know? And there is this plausibility almost argued. But if I'm a young teenager and I turn up in UAE or in Thailand or in Singapore and there's drugs in my suitcase and I say, I don't know how they got there, they'll say, great, you've got 50 years to figure it out. And off you go. And the international community will go, yeah, it's kind of what happens over there if you get caught. Whereas we just, as you say, the ROI for money laundering is quite high because the punishment is just not the same. And it is this sort of dual sort of, you know, misunderstanding of it doesn't seem as serious because it's not as scary as a shipment of drugs or narcotics or trafficked individuals. I mean, I would say you brought it on. You brought us on to this point accidentally. I mean, the reason this show is called Cease and Desist is because we were involved in helping a government sell a seized asset. And we got from a London law firm a wonderful cease and desist letter, because how dare we help the government sell a seized asset, because their third party, you know, their client, who is the offshore shell company, actually had a legal claim over the asset and we were selling it. So just by even telling the government we would consider helping them, that got us a cease and desist. So I know exactly what you mean when I've talked to other journalists who've got these really aggressive, is it the slaps? They've got these really aggressive sort of tools used against them. But just to maybe to finish it out for those that, you know, haven't experienced it, what is it actually like pulling a book like this together? Because, you know, you're stating some big facts, like from your own personal security and safety, right up to the legal and like litigation line. I can only imagine what that must be like, but perhaps you could share with us what it looks like and how long is something like this in the making?
Yeah, I mean, it's it takes a while. I mean, yeah, from the sort of origins, you know, to the end product, yeah, I guess it takes a really long time. But you know, it took me sort of, I think, probably all in, like, I don't know, 4 years, I think, or maybe 3.5. It depends on how you count it, because you know, you begin the reporting on something like this, it's sort of, you don't know exactly where you're going to end up, and you don't know exactly what you're going to get. And, you know, there are things where, you know, you have to try and, you know, map out what you know that you don't know. And then once you know that, you can sort of then start figuring out how you might be able to find that stuff out, to what extent it's possible, who will speak to you, you know, even who exists out there who could possibly speak to you.
Who's alive.
Yeah, who's alive, you know, who's and, you know, you're dealing with stuff in a lot of languages. Some of the languages I speak, some of the languages I don't speak. You have to, like, translate them. You know, you have to speak to people in lots of different countries, so all of that stuff takes a long time. But I think in terms of, you know, look, the personal security stuff, I think, you know, I wouldn't want to sort of over exaggerate that, and this is something you have to be mindful of. But, you know, it's very different being based in you know, a country like the UK than being based in, like, far, you know, there are journalists who are really based in really difficult places where reporters are regularly killed, and really tragically, there's very little consequence for the people who are doing that. I mean, you know, one of the worst things about the Prigozhin stuff I mentioned earlier is, as this guy was sort of hiring these expensive lawyers, you know, his there were I think three Russian reporters who went to investigate his activities in Africa who were murdered. They were ambushed on a road and murdered. And no one, to my knowledge, has ever really been held responsible for that. And so, you know, there's a sort of really sickening side to that sort of thing, where you have someone who is using their ill-gotten gains to hire these, like, extremely expensive, you know, respectable law firms, whilst also, you know, using hired goons to sort of murder reporters with the other hand. And so, you know, that sort of thing is just terrible. But you know, and but I think in terms of just the overall process of the book is something where, you know, you are also dealing with situations where people have different recollections of events, and so you have to spend a lot of time trying to talk to as many people who were there as possible, to sort of verify what you're hearing and understand, you know, the different interpretations of you know, people can be in one meeting and they can be a contested meeting, and obviously you speak to two different sides, they have different views of what happened. And so there's a lot of that as well. Yeah, it was a sort of often, you know, one of the biggest challenges with something like this is actually not what you put in, but what you leave out. Because you can have a huge amount of material and stuff and sort of side stories and angles, which, you know, you have to be try and be disciplined and not just, you can't just put everything in there. So actually
Squeeze everything in.
having too much material, it's you know, it wasn't necessarily a problem I thought I was gonna have, but I ended up with you know, so many things, you know, so many different, you know, relating to stuff in Italy, you know, sort of, you know, dozens of legal cases spanning over thousands of pages, you know, dating for, you know, spanning over like 20 years, you know, just relating to one family. And you know, you can really read into, you know, you can find out so much about these
You can do a
people.
Netflix special and just go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, there's a lot of rabbit holes you can go down to. So it's just trying to stay disciplined. It's also a big challenge. So it's not sort of just what you put in, but also what you leave out.
I know that anyone reading the book will really enjoy. For me especially, I absolutely, and I don't know if it's a wider methodology, but take all the credit yourself. But I loved your sort of referencing at the back and the notes referencing and being able to specifically sort of jump in. I found that really, really useful. I also know that coming out of this show, we always like to make sort of recommendations or insights. And I think you've done a great job at summing up. If it takes you this amount of time and complexity to try and map this and understand this, it probably does explain the fact why we don't see. Because imagine being a police officer restricted by borders, having multiple cases on, and also having all the bureaucratic things that you highlighted. For me, the book is a great example of why we don't have many money laundering investigations, as in you can only imagine what it's like without a tenacious officer trying to push things on and without political support. For me, I want sort of every politician to read it and understand unless we actually take away some of these barriers, we'll just simply not get these big cases being dealt with anymore. I also want to give you the moniker and the credit that you're in the school and the alumni of authors who can actually say without ChatGPT. Because I think that anyone going forward for the next, you know, from now on, it sort of seems like from t end of 2024 onwards, there's always that. A friend of mine's a publisher, he's
Yeah.
like, Whereas when you've had to put this together from actually reading all of the stuff yourself, put it, there should almost be a new, like a pricing premium that applies to anything sort of pre-2024.
That's funny. I hadn't really thought about that. Yeah, when I was doing the book, ChatGPT wasn't a thing. Yeah, I
I
mean,
could
I
just say, give me 20,000 pages on a or 20,000 words on a better version of this book, and in seconds it comes up.
Mean, in a way, it's an interesting point. I mean, it's one of the things that sort of, at least as far as I've seen it, AI won't be very good at doing, is
100%.
a lot of the stuff in this book is sort of connecting, you know, seemingly, you know, unconnected things up to the point of where one legal case falls off and another legal case opens up, you know, where frequently in these sorts of international criminal cases, you can have sort of people who are sort of captured in both, you know, and the crime sort of cross borders and they interact with different things. And that you know, one of the, well, just a small case study in that is obviously, you know, one of the people that Jack Kelly was involved in arresting was this arms dealer in the Czech Republic. And he was later the people who he was arrested in the Czech Republic, and a bunch of Czech citizens were then kidnapped in Lebanon and held hostage to get him released. And then in the so basically that was an interesting example of, you know, a sort of an American case where actually also there was a whole concurrent Czech case related to those hostages, and they're actually talking about exactly the same thing, but they hadn't really ever been viewed in kind of in sort of in the same in context in the same time. And so I think, yeah, that's a, so I wonder, maybe, you know, we'll see how AI does with that, but I don't know, that sort of stuff in different languages, different countries, different cases, it's they're not things which are obviously connected, but they are. And so
No, it's something, it's a slight aside, but it's something that I think people need to be very, very wary of. I mean, I worry genuinely that like future policy and things, when you see the amount of work that gets done and churned out across governments, across journalists, across everything, that is obviously, you know, there's going to be a good use of AI. But even in like prepping for this show and the work that we do, the amount of times we'll give it a task and it like I don't think people realize the scale of AI hallucinations. Like literally a previous guest who I'd said, I don't want to ask the same guest. They'd done like 50 podcasts in a row. And I said, I don't want to ask the same questions. What are the questions you know what I'd be thinking of just to give me some sort of inspiration? And it brought up like this anecdote about this time he was at this thing. And I know the guy. And I was like, I don't think that's something he was involved in. And when I drilled down, I went, oh yeah, sorry, that never happened. I was like, well, where did you draw that from? Oh, it's complicated the extreme how we know we do research, but basically that story is not true. And I would just be, I'd love to know how many things are just making their way through and being passed on as fact. But I suppose that can happen in journalism as well, depending on how good the editors are. If stuff can sort of slip the net. I think there can almost be a part two, Miles, where we can come back in a couple of years, because now we've had this big announcement from the UK with the FCA and NCA and the NEC, where there's these new sort of strategic pillars in terms of what the focus is on. I think a lot of the challenges you highlighted in the book, Interpol's new, you know, silver notice on seized assets, combined with the big interagency stuff that Europol is driving, things like Project Asset. We saw a lot of this in Operation Venetic coming out, so I'm sure there'll be plenty more stories emerging in this space. But I'm sorry, we've taken up so much time. I always try and plan these podcasts to be 30 odd
Not at
minutes or so. And
all.
I was like, I know it's an interesting story, and I didn't want to stop. So, yeah, thank you so much for your time today. And yeah, we will put a link into the book on the podcast notes as well. So hugely grateful for you joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Our podcasts are for informational purposes only. They are not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice. Listeners must consult their own advisors before making any decisions on the topics being discussed.